Honorable Vanzetta Penn McPherson is a retired U.S. Magistrate Judge for the Middle District of Alabama. She's my guest today on Like It Is. Judge McPherson earned her J.D. degree from Columbia University. Thank you, Judge McPherson, for joining me.
My pleasure to be with you.
Thank you very much. I was drawn to your opinion piece published in the Montgomery Advertiser entitled The Uncomfortable Alabama Mansion. I found it compelling and most interesting. I would like to read a few excerpts from that opinion piece and get your feedback, if that's okay with you.
That's fine.
Quoting from your opinion piece, the mansion has many rooms. Montgomery lives in one of them. The atmosphere in that room is arguably palatable to millennials, but it isn't alluring, end quote. Please elaborate on that particular section from your, that excerpt from your opinion piece, please.
The alluring part for millennials doesn't necessarily start with, but certainly includes the cost of living. For millennials, that's an important consideration because they usually aren't seasoned in their careers and they are out on their own some for the first time. So the cost of living in Alabama is lower than so many other states, and certainly the states where millennials typically want to live. But they have a difficult time adjusting to the lack of what they regard as progressivism. They have difficulty accepting the tendency of many Alabamians to cling to an old way of thinking and an old way of doing things. For example, distrust of the national government, a belief in white privilege, for example, a disdain for those who are different. Millennials who have grown up under different circumstances and with different relationships than their parents and grandparents think differently. And they are more accepting of differences. In fact, they are inclined to trumpet them, while their grandparents and parents tend to do that a lot less and some not at all.
Thank you for that. And I'll continue quoting. In the mansion's office, the governor has just refused to expand Medicaid, thus depriving more than 30,000 poor Alabamians of health insurance. She's meeting with legislative leaders who are gloating about the veto of Birmingham's adoption of a $15 minimum wage, while salivating over the prospect of overturning Montgomery's prospective enactment of an occupational tax, end quote. Elaborate on that section, please.
It's so ironic, and it's more than that. It's almost shameful that Alabama's status as one of the poorest states in the Union would fail to expand Medicaid. And the number, by the way, I know you meant to read it as 300,000, but it's 300,000 instead of 30,000.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We are seeing the result of that in part right now as we as a state and as individuals try to fight the coronavirus and COVID-19. Had Alabama expanded health insurance, first and foremost, we would have had more rural hospitals open, thereby giving greater access to people who live in rural areas to health care. Secondly, those individuals themselves would have had more protection from the high cost of health care, whether it's due to the virus or not. So you would think that with our being a poor state, we would, as I mentioned in the article, salivate over the prospect of expanding Medicaid, when instead we did not. And it was a matching program. Now, the excuse given is that in 2 or 3 years, Alabama would have to fund it itself. But as we are now seeing, what can be more important than health care, especially adequate health care? The second part of the quote that you read is something that can be expanded on and made a column in and of itself. The legislature is, or I should say governance in Alabama, is substantially compromised by the lack of home rule. And because we don't have home rule, namely because local governments, county governments, city governments, and in some cases boards cannot legislate without the approval of the Alabama legislature, we are behind in our ability to cloak. So when Birmingham decided, the city of Birmingham, that is, decided on its own to raise its pay for its city workers to $15 an hour, somehow or the other, the Alabama legislature vetoed that. Birmingham's government did not ask other governments to do it. Birmingham's government did not ask or do anything to compel private industry to do it, or any government workers except city employees. And yet the Alabama legislature overturned that vote. The same thing is true of Montgomery's thoughtfulness and consideration of enacting an occupational tax. The City Council of Montgomery is, as of today, favorable toward that enactment, but legislators in our state legislature have already begun forming opposition to that. It grows out of an effort to control everything that happens in the state. But frankly, it also grows out of an absence of thoughtfulness about statewide legislation. We just don't have thoughtful people in our legislature, generally speaking. So while they should be thinking about statewide legislation, they are concentrating or focusing their attention on what local governments are doing and how they can step in and control it. The third thing, which is not necessarily the third in rank, but the third thing that it involves is an effort to control what happens in majority black jurisdictions, such as Birmingham and Montgomery. And that can best be seen in the 15-hour minimum wage and, no, the occupational tax. Other cities have enacted occupational taxes, but the legislature is considering outlawing it for Montgomery, while not outlawing it for the cities that have already enacted it. Those cities, by the way, are not majority black jurisdictions. So one has to be mindful of that when we consider a legislature's desire to overturn what is in essence self-government by a local jurisdiction. And it's odd because the legislators in Alabama are the first to scream states' rights when the federal government seeks to impose a national mandate on states. So it's utter hypocrisy in addition to being excessively controlling.
Would you agree with the statement, the more things change, the more they stay the same, and how detrimental that mindset is and have been to states like Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, and so forth?
Yes, I would. And in agreeing with that statement generally, I am not suggesting that nothing has changed for the better, nor am I suggesting that everything that has changed can be overturned. I do believe that there are some changes that are well on their way to being, one, permanent, and two, irremediable, to the extent you would consider it something worth remediating. However, the statement, the more things change, the more they stay the same, is an indictment of attitudes in our state. Namely, when A doesn't work, we recast it and rename it and call it B, and let's see if it works. And then on to C and D and E. It is the same, it is motivated by the same beliefs, and it is designed to have the same outcome or the same impact. It's just called something different. So things appear to be changing when in fact they are not.
I want to wrap up a quote from your piece when you, as you speak to millennials, quoting, "Millennials may be okay with Montgomery's room, but they are unwilling to spend the rest of their lives trying to reform, redecorate, and repopulate the other rooms in Alabama's mansion." That was your conclusion. Was that an appeal to millennials to look beyond the current status quo? Or what were you thinking?
It is neither an appeal, Dr. Franklin, nor is it an invitation for them to do so. It is an observation. There is a such thing as fatigue. People become weary and fatigue fighting the same outdated way of thinking, the same outdated attitudes, the same outdated prejudices, the same outdated status of narrow-mindedness that they see among their family members, their friends, their neighbors, and they simply go elsewhere. That's not necessarily true only of white millennials. It is also true of black millennials. They become fatigued and weary with having to convince people of principles that they consider to be normal and natural. And they are unwilling to stay. All one has to do is to go around and ask families, where are your children? And to a very large extent, they are gone, and they will not return to Montgomery, which of course inures to the detriment of our community and our city, because we don't capture that talent and that innovation and that imagination to help us grow.
As I said at the top of the program, I was captivated in reading this editorial or opinion piece that you're commenting on now. And I was curious, and I am curious, what is your motivation in determining your editorial's first question? And the second part is, would you like to share some of your forthcoming editorial topics?
Well, I'll answer the second question first, and I won't answer it specifically. I have decided that during the course of the active spread of the virus that I will devote my columns to issues that the virus places before us. And I wrote about work and the impact of not working due to a virus. Last Saturday, I wrote a tribute to teachers, because parents of young children are experiencing homeschooling that most of them have never done before. And I'd like to think, as I mentioned in the article, that they are beginning to appreciate teachers more. So my upcoming columns, while I won't talk specifically about what they address, will certainly address angles and issues arising from the stay-at-home orders and just simply existing in a culture during which a pandemic is spreading. We are living different lives now, and those differences will definitely have an impact on what we do in the future, but also the way we think and the way we feel about our fellow human beings, in much the same way that 9/11 did, but I think more substantially than 9/11, and probably more enduring than 9/11. After all, 9/11 affected us basically at airports and in reporting what we see. But I think that there will be a more comprehensive change in our behavior and in our relating to each other after we, hopefully, after we find a vaccine to COVID-19.
Well, your answer dovetails into my next thought here that I'd like to get some further elaboration from you on. You and I, in this interview, are doing so during an unprecedented period in our lives as we deal with the coronavirus and its lethal impact on residents and communities in Alabama, specifically throughout the country, I should add. Specifically, what are your thoughts about the coronavirus and its disproportionately deadly impact on communities of color in Alabama?
My thoughts, let me say at the beginning that my thoughts are not based on medical science or any other science, because I'm not a scientist. But it is not difficult to understand that people who already have compromised health, either because of hereditary factors or behavioral factors, are more vulnerable to a virus. And our community, that is the black community, has less access to quality health care than other groups. And our community as a community is more inclined to, number one, contract diseases and conditions, and less inclined to receive adequate health care for it. And now that has to do with the simple availability of health care, but it also has a lot to do with the cost of health care. So with compromised access to health care already extant in our communities, it should not be a surprise that when a virus comes along, we are more affected than groups who have greater access to health. It is continuing proof that health disparities have to be addressed in our community. They really do have to be addressed. And I think that while I may personally decline to adopt this attitude, there are still people, black people, who don't trust medical science because they have very uncomfortable memories about their ancestors and others they know having been misused for medical purposes.
I'll read the statement, and you touched on this point earlier in the interview, but I'd like to read a statistic that I pulled from a journal. Alabama is one of only 14 states that have not adopted the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. Opponents of Medicaid expansion argue it would burden taxpayers and encourage dependency on government. The consequences of Alabama's refusal to expand Medicaid has contributed to the closure of 14 hospitals since 2010, more than half in rural areas. Alabama lost out on a $935 million net surplus that expanded Medicaid would have generated. In your view, Judge, what health care choice would poor Alabama residents living in the poorest counties have as rural hospitals in some of these counties closed during this coronavirus pandemic?
In theory, Dr. Franklin, they have no choice. And I don't say that to be an alarmist, but I think I say that as a matter of fact. They have no choice. Consider someone living in counties that have no hospitals, and in Alabama there are many of them. Transportation is an issue for so many people, so they have to drive to or be driven to the nearest hospital. That may not be possible. And without hospitals, there are no doctors practicing in hospitals. And without hospitals, there is no health structure, operating rooms, ventilators, ICUs. There is no structure for treatment because doctor's offices are not hospitals. So without the structure designed to treat a seriously ill person, many of these people, if they contract the virus, will die rather than get health treatment. And we're not just talking about the virus here. We are talking about strokes. We're talking about heart attacks. We're talking about any number of health issues that could arise that need immediate medical attention, to which those people have little, if any, access. And as a result, they will become sicker or they will die. What is fascinating about this, and I shouldn't use the word fascinating because it isn't fascinating, what's inexplicable about this is that looking at the electoral map of Alabama, one finds that these are the very people who have voted against their interests consistently, namely people who live in rural Alabama. They vote against their interests. They vote for representatives and other politicians who stigmatize expansion of Medicaid, when in fact the expansion of Medicaid will do them the most good. And I'm not just talking about the population in general. I'm talking about the fact, for example, that Alabama has, like other states, a serious opioid problem. So it's, as I said, inexplicable that people who are most in need of these services continue to vote against their own interests by supporting people who oppose expansion of Medicaid.
Historically, during World War II, Americans were asked to make sacrifices for the good of the country. In your view, opinion, are current shelter-in-place restrictions too unreasonable sacrifices to ask Americans to make?
Absolutely not, because sheltering in place or staying at home has a two-sided benefit. It is designed to benefit the person staying at home, to keep that person from coming in contact with infected people, and it is also designed to protect people on the outside. We now have, as has been reported, concrete evidence that some people infected with the virus remain asymptomatic or exhibit very few symptoms. They're not sick at all. And so one doesn't necessarily know whether one has the virus or not if one hasn't been tested. So without a stay-at-home order, or in the absence of one, people would continue to engage in close contact with each other, and the virus would spread more quickly. Everyone understands that. The stay-at-home, the coerced social distancing of China may have been done by a despotic regime, but as far as containing the virus is concerned, it worked. It also worked in Italy, not before they had tragic deaths, but eventually it worked. Every country that has engaged in stay-at-home orders has seen it work in terms of the rate of the spread of the virus. Even New York now is experiencing fewer hospitalizations per day and fewer deaths per day. They're still high, and they're still most regrettable, but at least it's coming down. So there are sacrifices we have to make. And you know, Dr. Franklin, when you consider the nature of the sacrifice, it's, yes, it's sacrificial, especially for those people who are not at work. But all one has to do is to consider the option. And when one considers the option, namely contracting the virus and becoming seriously ill, it's hard to spend a whole lot of time focusing on the deprivation, because the stay-at-home order or compliance with the stay-at-home order is not designed to make more money. It's not designed to have a new living room set. It's designed to stay alive, which is the most basic consideration or basic outcome we can hope for.
I wanted to wrap up my very informative and compelling interview with you on a comment, and hopefully get your response from James Dannenberg. He is and was a retired Hawaii state judge. He penned a column which says, "Has the U.S. Supreme Court become an errand boy for the Trump administration?" He served on the District Court in Hawaii, First Circuit, for 27 years. He said in part, and I'll read a little bit of in his resignation letter to Chief Justice John Roberts. He said, and I'll quote a bit of this, "Dannenberg compares the current Supreme Court with its boundless solicitude for the rights of the wealthy, the privileged, and the comfortable to the court that ushered in the Lochner era in the early 20th century, a period of profound judicial activism that put a heavy thumb on the scale for big business, banking, and insurance interests, and ruled consistently against child labor, fair wages, and labor regulations. Any thoughts on former Judge Dannenberg's comments?
I read Judge Dannenberg's article. I do not agree that the U.S. Supreme Court has become constructively an errand boy for the Trump administration or for business. Here is what I will say. I believe that we are now in an era where, notwithstanding Article 3 of the Constitution having conferred life tenure on federal judges and, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court justices in particular, that it appears from their opinions that we have more now than ever a number of judges on the court whose opinions are motivated more by political considerations. I'm not suggesting that they are motivated more by political considerations than by law, but opinions are not supposed to be motivated by political considerations at all. It appears that there are justices on the Supreme Court now who seek to honor or somehow reciprocate their appointments And that should not be the case. It doesn't matter if you were appointed by President Reagan, Bush, Clinton, second Bush, Obama, or Trump. It should not matter. And you're not appointed to the Supreme Court to represent a party or an ideology. You're appointed, presumably, as a crown on your achievement of competence, of positive notoriety, and contribution in the law, and contribution to the law. So, and that's what the life tenure is designed to erase, namely erase the tendency of people to express themselves politically on the court. The whole argument that the founders had about life tenure was based on that. Life tenure equals independence. So I'm saddened by the fact that not just the members of the Supreme Court, but federal judges in general, now more than ever, appear to be motivated by political considerations in their opinions.
And may I just ask one parting question? If there's such a thing as your proudest moment as a judge or as a lawyer, what would that be?
I didn't expect that question. I don't know that I have thought about it. If I had to say off the cuff without giving myself a lot of time to think about it, because as you may know, I've been retired now over 12 years, so remembering what happened is more of an issue now than it used to be. I'd have to say right now that my proudest moment as a lawyer or a judge was the victory that I helped to secure for a class of African American deputy sheriffs in Montgomery County. I sued Montgomery County in 1987 on behalf of four named plaintiffs based on race discrimination. The sheriff at the time was practicing overt race discrimination, as were his senior deputies. And without going into detail, that case concluded 5 years later in 1992 with promotions for some deputies, more distribution of the workload, which would give black deputies the opportunity for promotion and advancement within the department. And I am absolutely convinced that it hastened the day when we elected an African-American sheriff as we have today. So in terms of achievement, I think that's probably the proudest moment I had as a lawyer and a judge. My proudest moment as a judge was writing the opinion in Alabama's in the case brought by the Southern Poverty Law Center seeking to outlaw the hitching post in Alabama. You were not here at the time, but there was a time, believe it or not, when Alabama prisoners were hitched to a post and made compelled to stand in the sun for 2 hours, 4 hours, 8 hours as punishment for infractions while they were in prison. It was awful. It resembled, quite frankly, someone hanging on a cross, because it was a cross, a horizontal post that they were literally hitched to. Without expanding on the cruelty and the barbarism of it, I can truthfully say that my proudest moment as a judge was writing that opinion and having that opinion affirmed by the district judge, and ultimately by having the district judges, watching the district judge's opinion confirmed or affirmed by the Supreme Court.
My guest today has been the Honorable Vanzetta Penn McPherson, a retired U.S. Magistrate Judge for the Middle District of Alabama. Judge McPherson earned her JD from Columbia University. Judge McPherson, it's been an honor, a pleasure. Look forward to one day meeting you. Thank you for being a guest today on Like It Is.
Thank you, Dr. Franklin.
I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.